This is Stateside. I'm April Mayer. Michigan's wrenching conversation about equity has a way of reframing all kinds of different issues in our lives. Institutions that white people consider progressive are not necessarily viewed the same way by Black Michiganders. There's a new book that has laid out an extensive paper trail at the University of Michigan and the school's efforts to provide a diverse environment for higher education. In most ways, the author explains the university achieved almost the opposite effect. Matthew Johnson is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University, and his new book is Undermining Racial Justice: How One University Embraced Inclusion and Inequality. Matthew Johnson, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
We should say, as we begin, that Michigan Radio is a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan, just to get that bit of housekeeping out of the way. The purpose of the book was to show that the U of M adopted some of what Black student activists have demanded over the years in an effort to be a more equitable place for people to study and to work, but that the university did so selectively in favor of other values. Let's start with a bit about the university's founding and the values that were sort of inherent to its creation. Could you lay out a bit of the history?
Yeah, I mean, right from the start, when the regions start to meet, they have these two competing goals. And one of them is to be one of the premier universities in the entire country, not just a premier public university, but just premier university in the nation. And then they have this other goal that's there to provide access, broad access to all people of Michigan. But what I started to find once I dove into that early history in the 19th century was at every turn, when those values started to clash up against each other, they chose the value of a premier elite university over that value of access every time.
I wanted to ask a little bit about your research process. You yourself as an academic have some experience and understanding of how institutions of higher learning function. What were you most curious about?
Geez, I was curious about what administrators were actually thinking when they were putting these things together. You know, universities just aren't transparent enough about these things. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book is, you know, if we look at these really divisive issues in our country that we talk about all the time and debate all the time, the general public really don't know much about how things like affirmative action actually function. And so I wanted to just take some of the mystery out of that. And in all fairness, you know, mystery for myself too, even though I work in institutions, I don't really know how admissions work very well before I started this book. And I didn't really know exactly how affirmative action admissions worked before I started this book. And so it was taking some of the mystery out for me too.
I want to talk more about admissions, but first, I just wanted to ask, could you give us an example of an everyday aspect of student life? Maybe, for example, student housing. And give us an example of a university policy where administrators sort of undermined what they said they wanted to do.
So right from the start, I mean, really beginning in the mid-20th century, administrators had this idea about creating this multiracial community that would better race relations. And in the dorms, they started to figure out, one of the ways that they did this was they said, we're going to make sure that students can't choose roommates based on race. And it sounded like a really good idea in the mid-20th century. But what they started to do was bring white students and African-American students together in the dorms, and African-American students experienced this intense racism and also social alienation. And so as they started to experience that, especially by the mid-1960s, Black students started to say, hey, why don't you give us the opportunity to live with another Black student? And of course, we're going to be within this larger dorm where we're constantly going to be interacting with white students. But just give us this little space to be together in the dorms. And the University of Michigan said no. And Black students tried to create lots of different small spaces on campus as areas where they could go to be exclusively with other Black students. And the university again and again said, no, that's not possible.
What interested you about the period that sort of followed the 1960s, a time when many students, and not just Black students, were speaking out about the need for a more inclusive and integrated environment?
Yeah, I really wanted to see, you know, especially after the 1960s, going to the 1970s and 1980s, there's this amazing period, especially in the late 1960s and early 1970s, where students really seem to have a lot of power. And they win some victories at the University of Michigan. But I wanted to see what happens after that. what happens after they don't have that sort of organizing power.
When sit-ins aren't, you know, the order of the day and things are going back to what mainstream America thinks of as normal.
Yeah, that's right. When they don't really have that same sort of organizational power, administrators really take back over the agenda of racial justice. When they're not worried about the consequences of their actions, it goes back to status quo.
Tell me a little bit about what you learned about the evolution of admissions policies at the university.
Yes, this is one of the more surprising things that I learned. So early on, the University of Michigan creates its first affirmative action program in 1964. And it was largely focused on working class Black students living in Michigan cities, especially Detroit, but also Grand Rapids and Flint. And by the mid-1970s, that completely changes. They changed their focus to focus on middle-class African-American students, mostly living outside of cities. If they look at cities, they are only focusing on these select admit high schools. And if people are listening from Detroit, they'll recognize the two high schools that the University of Michigan selected students from, and that was Cass and Renaissance. And that's largely the only two schools that they're willing to recruit from in Detroit. And so it's the shift from kind of a working-class focus to a middle-class focus.
What does that signal to you?
That signals to me that administrators really aren't interested completely or wholly in this value of equity and access.
Some of the narratives around higher education, the idea that a school like Michigan could or should be really grounded in merit and qualifications. I mean, no doubt this was a value that administrators showed they were committed to, but it also feels like the kind of thing that might make donors want to give to the university. And you point out that, you know, there's definitely evidence that some of the people who were involved in drafting the University of Michigan's policies really did, you know, aspire to change. You know, they said it even as decisions were being made that totally undermined what they were trying to do. There were people of good faith being involved in this. Do you think there is a nexus between what activists need out of universities, what students need out of universities, and what universities need to do to stay financially vital?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that comes in, especially when we start talking about diversity. And one thing that administrators have been really good at, and I argue in the book it's a bad thing, but administrators have been really good at turning student diversity into a marketable value, almost a monetary value, in which they can get lots of money from donors and celebrating its diversity. But they can also market the university to white students as this wonderful place where you can come get an education. And it's part of that really expensive tuition that you're paying for at the University of Michigan is your access to students of color.
Do you see that still playing out at the university to this day?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, this is part of the ambiguity of diversity. Despite the fact that, for example, African-American numbers have gone way down, the University of Michigan still sells itself as this amazing, diverse place. And the concept of diversity allows administrators to do that because it's not attached to a number, right? It's like, how many Black students do you need to create a diverse community? How many next students do you need? How many Asian-American students do you need? How many Native American students do you need? Administrators, they never attach a numerical value to that. But numbers can go up and down, no matter what, and they can still sell the place as a diverse community.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with historian and author Matthew Johnson of Texas Tech. His new book is called Undermining Racial Justice, How One University Embraced Inclusion and Inequality. And it looks at the University of Michigan's attempts to diversify its student body and faculty, and the resulting status quo that emerged. I think a lot of the things that the average person knows about the University of Michigan's policies on race come from two very high-profile Supreme Court decisions that happened in the early 2000s, Gratz versus Bollinger and Grutter versus Bollinger. And they, in effect, ran a sword through affirmative action policies. Could you talk about what you see the decisions having done to the U of M's approach?
Very little, actually. I mean, they're in the undergraduate practices, of course, they had to change the mechanisms in their actual admissions practices. They were giving a specific point value to every African-American applicant. But the sort of goals that they had and the values that they had, the way that they generally ran admissions, didn't change very much afterwards. And in fact, despite the fact that there might be comments in the media about how this might be a loss, behind the scenes, even Gratz, which the University of Michigan lost, was a huge victory for the University of Michigan. And certainly Grutter was a bigger one. But the Supreme Court endorsed the argument that the University of Michigan didn't need to recruit low-income students. It endorsed the idea that diversity could be a very ambiguous thing, not attached to any numbers. It endorsed all sorts of things the University of Michigan was already doing. And so when you go back in and look at, well, how did Gratz and Grutter really affect Michigan? It's not much.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote in the Grutter decision that the court expects that 25 years from now, and I'm quoting here, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today. So it's 2020. We're 17 years out, not 25, but I wonder about your assessment of what she wrote in that decision and where Michigan stands right now.
She's come out and made the comment that she's kind of regretted that comment that she made in that decision. One of the reasons why I think she regrets it, if you look at a place like the University of Michigan and look at the number of Black students that are on campus, their share of the student population today is about the same as it was in the late 1960s. That's amazing to think about, that before the big, very famous Black Action Movement strike in 1970, and afterwards, Black student population goes up to about 7% by the mid-70s and then goes back down. But we're back to a period before the Black Action Movement strike of 1970 in terms of student population. We've gone backwards since these big student strikes of the early 1970s.
Was it difficult to get the source materials that you needed to write the book?
Oh my gosh. I was really naive when I started this book because I thought I was going to write a big national study of affirmative action around the country. I was going to pull back the mystery from affirmative action all throughout the United States. But pretty quickly, what I think a lot of people realize is that universities are not very transparent about what they're doing. And universities around the country have generally hidden, got rid of, or have locked up these sorts of sources. If I wanted to do research at Harvard, Harvard locks up their stuff for 50 years, and so I could only get up to 1970. The University of Michigan is a really special place. There's no university in the entire country that's made available as much of its past as the University of Michigan. And so they have memos, research reports, all sorts of communication between low-level and higher-level administrators about racial equity and affirmative action. I would never have been able to write this book about any other place.
Wow. Not even schools that you've worked at.
That's exactly right. I've actually filed FOIA requests at schools that I've worked at, and I've gotten very little back.
Oh my gosh. Have you come to any conclusions about what it means to let go of more traditional virtues, you know, the very traditional values of academic merit and qualifications as they have been understood through the 19th and 20th centuries? And if we were to think about building a population that more closely mirrors the state, did you come to any new conclusions about what that would look like?
The most basic one that I think has to happen, and of all the things that I came to, this is going to sound hard, but it's the easiest to do, is that we need to disconnect the way that we measure the quality of an institution or its elite status from the supposed quality of the student body at the time that they apply. Right? So if you think about how we measure the quality of institutions or the reputation, it's by the SAT scores of students when they apply, the high school grades of students when they apply. It has nothing to do with the quality of education that happens once they're there. So if you imagine if we rated hospitals this way. Imagine if we rated hospitals by the health of patients when they show up and check in versus the quality of care that they get when they're there. That would sound crazy to us. But we're willing to go with that sort of system in higher education. And it's a system that creates racial inequality.
One of the things that struck me as so significant in the book is you really spend some time outlining what happens when you channel efforts of inclusion into one office or one administrator or one executive, instead of making it part of the institution's entire ethos. Could you talk a little bit about what that difference can mean?
Yeah. So one of the techniques that the people really high up at the University of Michigan used to be able to resist change. It was after a movement, after a big social movement or protest, they would create this new position, whether it's a diversity officer or assistant to the president, someone that looked like a very important position. And they would give it virtually no power to do much of anything, no budget, no power to hold people responsible. And that doesn't produce any sort of change at all. I mean, the only power is the hope that that person can go around the university and convince people with power to make changes, which never happened. There's a big difference when you force people who already have power to accept the idea, to embrace the idea of racial equity and put that into practice. That has rarely ever happened at the University of Michigan.
You know, it was kind of disheartening to read the book and just read example after example of what you're talking about. There'd be a spike in public interest and student interest in meaningful change, and there would be, you know, proclamations and new positions created. And like you say, these weren't necessarily very toothsome and didn't result in a lot of change. Obviously, the country is going through a huge conversation right now about how institutions can change. What have you learned about how institutions can start to seriously approach questions of inclusion?
Yeah, I think that it starts at the top of the university. And it starts at the top with a president holding people accountable for their actions, holding people from the top, from the people right below that person to the bottom. And that means potentially firing people. It means potentially connecting their raises to following through on racial equity goals. But it always starts at the top of an institution and holding people accountable for their actions. Otherwise, there might be change in one part of the institution, but not another. And an entire university has to change to make the quality of life much better for African-American students.
Matt, you've spent a truly massive amount of time researching and analyzing U of M's racial disparities and everything the school did to try to rectify the situation. Do you feel like you got one big takeaway out of all this about what worked and what didn't?
You know, the one big takeaway I have from this book is that, you know, seeing universities as bastions of racial justice is a huge mistake. The story isn't one of administrators giving in to every or even most demands of activists. But the real story is this resistance to change. And what's even more amazing that I found in this book is the story is these administrators who are resistant to change and involved in perpetuating racial inequality, that these people somehow in their mind convince themselves that they're champions of racial justice.
Matthew Johnson is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech. He's just published a book called Undermining Racial Justice: How One University Embraced Inclusion and Inequality. Matthew, thank you so much for your time today and for the book.
Thank you for having me.